Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program. Now here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today we'll be joined by Democracy for America Chair Jim Dean, Georgia State Senator Nan Grogan Orrick, CrooksandLiars.com Managing Editor David Neiwert, and Campaign for America's Future Research Director Eric Lotke. We've been joined by Jim Dean, the Chair of Democracy for America. So tell us about your launch of the Move Your Money campaign.
Well, we just launched that one this week. We're back up a little bit. We're an organization that was founded by my brother Howard of about a million members around the country, about 400 groups. Big training program. We've supported about 1,000 candidates, mostly running for office. And one of the issues we've worked on is this Move Your Money, which we're doing in conjunction with the Huffington Post and with Michael Moore, the filmmaker. And the whole thing behind this is really for the consumer to speak out and draw attention to not only the incompetence, but frankly, a lot of bad behavior that we've seen from the big players in the financial services industry. There are a lot of very good financial service companies. Many of them are community-minded. We think it's going to help a lot if we could start moving our money into those community-minded institutions rather than have them with some of these big banks that really have frankly created a huge mess. And once we get done with that, or as we're doing that, we're going to ask our local Democratic parties. Our members are going to ask their local Democratic parties, and if they can, local municipal governments and maybe even state Democratic parties to also move their money so that we can build on really what would be not just really a protest, but more really sort of finding a way to do financial services business in a more sustainable way with companies that are more accountable to the public.
And as you start to talk about it, let's go back to the history for Democracy for America. Mm-hmm. I know, you know, most of our listeners would certainly remember your brother's campaign for president, and that, you know, he was one of the first to really speak up about the problems and, you know, the war on terror and where we were going wrong. Did the organization kind of grow from that, obviously?
Yeah. What happened is his presidential campaign ended in the spring of 2004, and he wanted to, you know, we had this big national network of, at the time, about 350,000 people. Folks who weren't ready to give up on politics, who weren't ready to give up on trying to change this country for the better. So we started Democracy for America, and the original idea was really to try to help folks who were running for office locally more than anything else, to help the folks that were out there trying to be active to make a difference. And what's happened is that he went, of course, to the Democratic National Committee, and so and we really tried to not only just do this for running for office, but to help people when they want to join their local parties, when they want to volunteer on a school board, when they want to be on a planning and zoning committee. You know, it's hard to do that. It's hard to have a job all day and take care of the folks you love and go to one of these meetings for 3 hours at night, or go phone bank people who might not be happy to hear from you at 8 o'clock at night. It's pretty tough. So, you know, we had this training program going. You know, the groups that have been out there have been incredibly supportive of each other, and really, I wear this chairman label when I'm down here in Washington, but what we really are, network administrators, to try to bring these ideas together among this network that's now grown to over a million people, to really be a vehicle to help people take responsibility over the political process.
And, you know, a lot of people, obviously, it's easier to focus on a national level, you know, you might unite over something, but really in making fundamental change, when people say think globally but act locally, that really has been sort of the missing link in some of this. If you want to get involved at the state and local level and make some progressive change, you know, how does one go about doing that? And talk about some of the significant victories you've had with that.
Well, here's I don't consider this a victory from an ideological standpoint, but let's take California, for example. Now, the California Democratic Party has a very transparent process if you want to join. You can run in an election to be a representative from your assembly district for the party, as well as for the voters as a whole, but this is a different election, and you can run as a party. And a lot of folks, our members, did that, and many of them are now in positions of responsibility within the party 4 or 5 years later. And, you know, they're opening the party up more and more to making it a more transparent vehicle. Now, all these folks don't necessarily agree with each other on the types of resolutions or the types of stances the party should take, but it's really an example of a citizen-dominated or a party becoming citizen-dominated than just necessarily being dominated by, you know, a culture of incumbency. You know, some of our best friends are incumbents, but they're incumbents because they behave like like activists, and we need to instill that kind of activism both in Congress and the Senate, but also in our local communities. So there are a lot of there are many races where we've supported candidates locally for school board where they've had these creationist versus evolution debates, and there are a lot of environmental issues, developer issues that are going on in small towns every single day, and folks are running for office and winning those races and having a voice in government.
And I remember that it was very controversial having a 50-state kind of program and the mm-hmm. idea behind that, but yet for the activists that are out there, it's always very frustrating when the political consultants walk into a campaign, especially near the end, and say, okay, we're going to turn out the vote heavily in just a couple of segmented places. And if you don't live in those segmented places, you feel like you're completely ignored by politicians, the party apparatus, the elections. Have you found, as this has been experimented with, that not only does it turn out a greater vote to target everybody in a way, but it also really has changed the funding mechanism for campaigns?
Well, I absolutely agree with that. I have this little saying, the party that empowers will be the party that's in power. And particularly in a lot of places where we're doing our weekend trainings, which in a lot of those places are down south, you know, you get people showing up saying, hey, I didn't know there were other folks who believe the same things that I do, or believed in open and responsive or reforming government. And once that network starts, it can't be stopped. And I think the days of consultants deciding, hey, there are no votes here, we're not going to pay any attention to them, are over. We saw for generations, political campaigns always said, well, we can't go after younger voters because they never vote. And that became a self-fulfilling prophecy. And now we've seen that that's gone out the window. And I think, with communities being connected by the Internet and all of these organizing tools, it makes sense to not only be running just as hard in Wyoming as we are, say, in Connecticut, where I live, but frankly, it makes more sense because if we're not bringing our message to these parts of the country, we're not going to even get anything done if we win.
And do you think this actually played a role in President Obama's election? I mean, just the whole new way in which we campaign now, the fact that people might be living out of a jurisdiction, but they can do phone banking with their cell phone at night. They don't have to be in that jurisdiction. They can send email to their friends. They can raise money online.
Huge. And I think that's got a lot of to do with why he won North Carolina in particular, and why he won Indiana. Virginia was sort of a swing state, but those are two states that nobody expected him to win. And he won in part because of that, but also in part because there were some very, very good candidates running for other offices in those states who did not prevail, but got the vote out in their own right. So it becomes a situation where you're not depending on one side of the ticket, the top or the bottom, to win. You can depend on both of them or have both of them if you're doing that kind of empowerment, if you're doing a 50-state strategy, if you're doing, as they're doing in California, a 58-county strategy, which they're doing, those types of things in all kinds of different states. So got to do it. Got to get out there and vote. Got to be active.
Now, let's also promote your organization a little bit there. If people want to find out information, what's your website?
That would be democracyforamerica.com, and all kinds of fun tools and training materials there for you if you want to go and check it out and find out how to get involved in politics.
Now, the night school process that I think you all kind of have really brought up for folks, I mean, I know the DNC has done that traditionally in some ways, but sometimes in a way that might be inaccessible for people that are maybe not in Washington or not in a mm-hmm. large city. Are you finding that's been a real unique success for you all?
Yeah, it is. There's some great programs out there for training, and of course, Wellstone is one of the originators of all of this, and they're fantastic, and there are other training programs that are great. Our part of this is that, we've been able to go to a lot of out-of-the-way places, either through the night school program, which is online, or through our weekend trainings in places like Jackson, Mississippi, and Birmingham, Alabama. And, we know in our model, we're not going to get quite as many people as the other training programs would get, but we're going to go there because we know if we do, that's going to start the ball rolling. And we know if we wait for 200 people to sign up, we're never going to get there. So, we have a little bit of a build it and they will come type of strategy, and that might inure to our benefit or somebody else's, but mostly it'll inure to the activist's benefit.
And for those activists that do kind of stand up in those places, funding is obviously a big problem. When you're an incumbent, it's easy to kind of twist arms and get money.
Yep.
And particularly in the traditional ways, I mean, even just picking up the phone and, calling people. Mm-hmm. But for the first-time activist that's jumping out there or challenging maybe an incumbent who has funding from the far right, what kinds of things can you all do? What kinds of things are out there for people who want to stand up?
Well, the big thing, the way we approach this, at least in our training program, is about trying to use the resources of people, time, and money, and understanding that there are limits to that, and understand how to maximize all of those, whether it's on volunteer recruitment, whether it's on raising what money you can from family, friends, and neighbors, and especially on making sure that you targeted your votes correctly and you know exactly how many you win so that you're not overemphasizing on something you don't need to overemphasize on. And once you get that part of it down, then it's about expanding networks and either for financial, you know, for financing the campaign or for getting the votes out. But the big thing is, our thing is trying to get people focused on using those resources wisely.
And do you find that it's not just about electing people to office, but I know I get your emails fairly regularly, and I know that
you
guys were very active on the healthcare debate and clearly made a difference. I mean, Joe Biden was right that it was a big deal.
Yeah.
you know, and obviously with the banks issue, you know, are you finding that in some ways it's bringing a lot of allies together? I think the healthcare thing brought a lot of people to the table that maybe had been working in other areas but more coordinated with somebody like Michael Moore. Are you finding with the bank issue that you're getting progressives all over the place kind of uniting around the issue?
Yeah, I'm a huge believer in coalitions. In fact, we even have a training piece in our night school about how to build coalitions, how to manage them, how to understand your own expectations as well as manage expectations of others. Very, very important. You know, we each year we do more and more work with other groups. On the healthcare debate, it was huge. And you know, we understand the power of this right now and that it's exponential. It's exponential in the case of the work that we're doing on Bill Halter's campaign right now and generating all of these voter contacts that are going on all over the country right now. We understand how we work better, and when you do that, you can maximize that better. But I'm a big believer in coalition building, and the more of it that's in there, the more powerful we'll be, particularly in getting decent legislation passed.
And for people on the left, I know over the last 18 months we've heard a lot of people saying that they've been very frustrated. They thought, you know, we elected the change, that change was going to happen, and that frustration needs to be channeled in some fashion. Are you all finding that you're able to bring that to bear? I mean, you're talking about the Arkansas race, for instance. I mean, that's a good example of kind of trying to make the change that we voted for.
Yeah, I you know, it's both that and a lot of local legislation and federal legislation. Campaign finance reform is a big part of this thing. I think, you know, we all were enamored with getting the House and the Senate back in 2006, 2008, getting the White House. But we know we're up against a lobbying structure, a culture of incumbency, if you will, that's not going to go away quietly. And we've got to keep at it, and we've got to keep working hard to make that happen. This is an ongoing process. Obama's election was the beginning and not the end. And, you know, in the expression, either in this Primaries Matter campaign that we're running on behalf of Halter, Elaine Marshall, Joe Sestak, and others, but also in fighting for health care reform, Move Your Money campaign. If we're doing this stuff, it's not a matter of if, it's only a matter of when. It's when we give up and say, well, we elected the Democrats and now it's their turn to do everything what we want, that's when we're going to get into trouble. So we got to still have at it.
And for more information on the Break Up the Banks campaign, go to www.breakupbigbanks.com.
Move your money.
Move your money. We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com.
Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. You'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from. Start shopping today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Ward Morrow. We've been joined by Nan Grogan Orok, the Georgia State Senator from District 36. Welcome to Inside Government.
Thanks so much. Good to be with you.
So let's talk about what's going on down there in Georgia. What are some of the big issues that are happening?
Well, like a lot of the states, we're facing our elections this year. We're choosing all of our statewide constitutional officers, so we're in election season, and we've suffered the most devastating hit on our state budget since the Great Depression, I think it's safe to say. All the states but a couple are struggling to keep their heads above water. Georgia's benefited greatly from the federal stimulus package. We've doubled the amount of federal dollars in our budget that we're putting to good use in Georgia. We, at the same time, unfortunately, have been under the leadership of people who are cutting taxes for the wealthy, and which helps damage our state budget revenues and puts us in a curious situation when we're facing furloughing teachers, $2 billion hit to education, a $22 billion state budget that's gone down to between $17 and $18 billion. You know, huge hits to the budget. So we are in a heavy debate around tax policy. And that's I think, going to be the case in a lot of states.
And so that we get the perspective of what it's like at the state level, if the bailout money had not come forward, what kind of cuts were you looking at potentially?
Well, severe cuts to the state agencies, and education and health and corrections are the three large budget items in any state budget typically. And we could have shut down every agency in the state except for those three agencies and still not have had enough money to meet the shortfall had we not had the federal stimulus package. Now, it's curious because on the one hand, you will see Republican politicians in Georgia, attacking Washington and castigating the president and introducing legislation, nullification, and that we don't have to go with the federal health reform and we're not going to do this and we're not going to do that. But on the other hand, we would be underwater if it hadn't been for the federal stimulus dollars. And we've doubled, I believe, from I think from $4 billion to $8 billion. We've taken in $3 billion of new federal money through the stimulus package. So tell me that doesn't help a state economy.
So for the folks there on the far right who, don't want to see taxes, don't want to see government spending, think government's too big. Obviously, it sounds to me that if you hadn't had that federal stimulus money, I mean, this would have impacted teachers, it would have impacted correctional officers and people in prison. I mean, usually, that should be a priority, public safety.
You're absolutely right, Ward. It would have been a devastating blow. And the job loss is just stunning that we would have experienced. And we'll still be facing this next year. Our budget woes have not gone away. And some of the federal infusion of funds won't be another hit. I mean, frankly, I think it's a shame we weren't able to have a bigger stimulus package than we had. But the right wingers in Congress, worked effectively to block that. The stimulus is a good thing, and you can just look at any state's budget, and you see there were many state leaders said they weren't going to take it. Well, they've taken that money. You better believe they've taken the money. We're also working. I head up a group of legislators across the country that are in state houses, in the chambers, in the states, and we work to have them linked up with what's going on here in Washington, because the policy and budget decisions that are made in Washington absolutely directly affect how we balance our budgets in the states and what services we're able to offer. And we've had over these last 25 years, I guess you'd say since Reagan came in, which is now, 40 years? Who's counting when you're having this much pain? But we've had a drastic reduction in federal funds coming to the states, to the cities, for example, to youth programs, training and education and recreation. And the states have been struggling. We believe that it's very important for women to be involved in politics. We believe that women legislators do bring a fresh eye, and often we come from the ranks of having battled over school issues and quality of life issues and things very close to the ground, very close to the voters' hearts, and bringing that perspective into politics and out of the back rooms, smoke-filled back rooms, as they used to say, that we believe women bring a fresh eye and a fresh voice to policy. And we work particularly with women legislators to let them know what's going on in Washington and how the decisions made here in D.C. impact what they're able to do or not able to do to meet their constituent needs. And in particular, the federal budget line for the Pentagon, we believe, is just way out of control. For our discretionary spending each year in Washington, we're now spending between 54% and 56% on Pentagon spending, far dwarfing the spending that we do on other programs. And when you compare the defense spending, the military spending that we do with all the other nations, our military budget is the size of all the other military budgets put together in the world. So we're way out of whack, I think, and out of balance. And we've not been doing smart spending. A lot of national security things have fallen to the states, frankly, like the security for some facilities that are in states that need to be highly protected, and the states are picking up the cost. So we work with women legislators to inform them and engage them in what's going on in Washington so they can explain that and be a voice in their state, and they can also be a voice from their constituents to the people in Congress making these decisions.
And you mentioned it's an election year. How is that kind of playing out? It seems we've had some other guests on who have said that in Democratic districts, women seem to be running in some ways equal to, in many cases better than men, but in more competitive districts that are more evenly split, are women winning in those districts as well, or are they having a more difficult time?
Well, I don't want to make a blanket statement because there are all sorts of different scenarios playing out in the states. I've got a good friend, Joyce Elliott, who came in, who's the top vote getter in the congressional seat that Vic Snyder vacated in the Little Rock, Arkansas. African-American woman, a lifetime school teacher, and the majority leader in the Senate, and she outdistanced the Speaker of the House. He outspent her 3-1. She took 30,000 votes to his 21,000 votes, and they're in a runoff tomorrow. So there's a case. And, of course, that's the land of Blanche Lincoln, too. It's going to be very interesting to see how all of that plays out, that election in particular. But when you raise the question of women in elections, I immediately think of Senator Joyce Elliott and her battle tomorrow. I expect that she may be successful against all the odds. It's not a majority black district that Vic Snyder represented. I think women overall do well now in times of national security peril, when the voters are voting out of fear. They have to really be shown that the woman can hold her own against a male candidate. There's that old stereotypical thing that women can't be tough, so that is something that we have to work on and in convincing voters. But overall, I think voters see women as communicators, listeners, problem solvers, practical, roll up their sleeves and get the job done. Don't worry who gets the credit. And we are much more evenly matched nowadays than if you look at 5 or 10 years ago, certainly. Voters are turning to women. I mean, we have had a majority city council in Atlanta, a women mayor. Our numbers aren't growing as fast as they should, but they're going in the right direction. Women Legislator Lobby, which is the national network of progressive women legislators, has a PAC and supports women and urges women to run for Congress. And 47 of our people that we've backed and that came through our ranks are in the Congress now, in the House and in the Senate. So we think we need to speed that process up and bring more women into the mix. And it'll be interesting to see. I won't prognosticate. It's a big country, 50 states. But it'll be interesting to see the seats and the results of these midterm elections. It's a time when we're talking with women and men legislators across the country, too, about getting involved in this START treaty. Your listeners are probably aware of that, but it might not be on the front burner for them. But it's the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty that's just been negotiated, and President Obama negotiated and signed that treaty with Russia. The Russian president signed it. The Senate has to ratify it. It takes a supermajority, 67 votes. So we've been working across the country with our women legislators and with their male colleagues, urging them to ask people to rise above partisanship and cast a vote to be reducing the number of nuclear warheads in Russia and in the U.S. And folks, that's one of the places that you save money. We spend an enormous amount on a huge nuclear stockpile, again, much larger than we need. And this treaty would be one of the things that helps reduce that and reduce the cost to the taxpayer of a bloated barn of missiles and nuclear weapons, and I think reduces insecurity, global insecurity, as well as increases national security. So that's something that we're working on, as we say, night and day. It's going to take a bipartisan vote, Ward, to ratify that treaty, and we've seen such rancor in the Congress over the last year in the health debate that it really needs a different attitude brought to a vote like this. And we've got a very significant bipartisan effort. You know, Senator Lugar in Indiana has been very active and involved on this issue for years. It's going to take a dozen Republicans to rise above party and do the right thing. So that's something that we're working on a day-by-day basis for a vote this summer.
And as we come into our last minute, let me ask you back into Georgia. I was at a conference last week. People were saying that there was a working families coalition of state legislators.
That's
in
right.
Georgia.
I'm one of the you're talking to the founder of that.
And I've heard it's quite effective, actually. I didn't know I was going to be interviewing you today, but I heard from a lot of folks it's been very effective. It's not been labor itself, but it's been a coalition. How did that come together, and what kinds of things have you been working on?
I work with a lot of national legislator groups, and we got a grant and had a retreat of Georgia legislators to talk about how to build a progressive caucus of legislators in Georgia. We named ourselves the Working Families Caucus. We had labor leaders in Georgia that weekend at our retreat helping us in our thinking, and we meet weekly during the session with labor. Labor is there, the legislators are there, and the different advocacy groups. That's an important communication path. Now, this year we defeated a last-minute effort on the last night to change the law and prohibit a checkoff. It would have required any worker who was in a union or an association to have to every 6 months send a certified letter saying, I still want my dues checked off. Well, we whipped that bad boy on the floor of the Senate on the last night, and those victories in a state that's overwhelmingly controlled 100% by Republicans, that's an important victory, and we've had others where they try to treat unions differently and discriminate against them. We're there in the mix.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFG's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. You'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from. Start shopping today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by David Nywert, the managing editor of CrooksandLiars.com and author of Over the Cliff, How Obama's Election Drove the American Right Insane. Welcome to Inside Government.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we were talking just before we got started. I actually saw something on the internet about the top 10 things, I guess, that drive the right crazy, and some people sent it to me, and it's been floating around. Tell me about that.
Well, Steve Levingston of the Washington Post asked us to put together a little piece to help promote the book. And so I put together this, and he wanted something, you know, sort of items, that things that might be, you know, sort of a list produced by the book. But I decided instead to come up with sort of a continuation of the conversation, and I came up with the 10 provably untrue things that Tea Partiers believe. Part of it was that I was on the Rachel Maddow show about 2 months ago, and she was going to ask me, but never did ask me, the question, you and John have a book coming out now called Over the Cliff, How Obama's Election Drove the American Right Insane, and then her question was going to be, insane? and of course, it's a little bit of hyperbole. We don't mean clinically insane or anything like that. Einstein defined insanity as doing something over and over again and expecting the same result. It's sort of a rhetorical device, of course, but... We think that, you know, I think that believing things that are provably untrue is a kind of insanity as well. I mean, it means you're not all there or something's wrong in your thinking process. And Tea Partiers believe, I mean, everything from, of course, the number one on the list, of course, is the birther conspiracy. But we had a long list of things that, you know, that they believe that simply are provably untrue. And you can throw the facts in their faces, and they don't care. They're going to believe it anyway. And that's insane.
I constantly get these emails, and I'm sure our listeners do and everybody else, that, you know, outrageous things, you know, something that a candidate of the left is doing. They're not saluting at something, and they say they're at Fort Hood when they're not at Fort Hood, or they're, you know, at a memorial when they're not, or they're not doing this. And this has been going on now for a couple of years, and it's the same people who keep, at least with me, keep sending me this stuff.
Usually your brother-in-law, right?
That kind of thing, yeah. And, you know, I know there's websites out there like Snoop, you know, and Urban Legends and things like that that kind of retort some of these things. But let me ask you, have you done any research into where is this stuff coming from? Who's putting this stuff out?
Well, that is a good question. We've tried to trace some of it. It's, you know, of course, the email forward is the classic thing. And Chris Hayes did a really good piece for The Nation about 2 years ago on the email forward. Nobody's really sure where they originate, but they seem sometimes to originate with right-wing operatives. Like Floyd Brown was very active in 2008. The guy who was behind the Willie Horton thing back in 88. Is still very much with us, and in 2008 he was involved in creating a lot of the Obama is a Muslim type email forwards and helping to create the energy around that. Some of it comes from places like WorldNet Daily, some of the really far right news sources, and of course WorldNet Daily is notorious for running provably untrue stories. So.
Is there, I mean, you know, we live in the First Amendment. Everybody's got a right to, you know, freedom of speech, obviously,
sure.
And we all support that. But, I mean, when people are putting out these kinds of things, I mean, it does force a lot of folks to then have to go and research all this stuff and then try to re-forward out to all these same people that
That's
it's not
right.
true. I mean, after a while,
and
doesn't it just make people cynical?
By which point, it's the lie has already embedded itself in the public consciousness in a lot of ways. So it's... It's really horribly toxic for the national conversation because it makes it fundamentally irrational. You know, we're not talking facts or anything. We're talking about crazy ideas, crazy beliefs that have no basis in reality, and we wind up devoting hours and hours and hours debating them. One of the reasons we did the book, of course, was to try to provide people with a useful resource so that they can go and see what the facts are in terms of, you know, especially a lot of the stuff that's been trotted out in the last year about Obama. We also put online at Crooks and Liars, we actually, instead of doing the endnoting in the book, we did all of our endnoting online, all of our documentation online, so that because we have kind of a unique thing. Crooks and Liars is primarily known as a video blog. We almost all of our posts have videos on them. So, and a lot of our documentation for the book goes back to the work we did at Crooks and Liars. So if you go to the website and go check out our documentation, you can not only read the articles themselves that we reference, but you can actually go and watch people saying these things that we quote them throughout the book saying. You can watch the video, and you can decide for yourself whether we're accurate. And as unlike the right, believe in total transparency. We want everybody to know the truth. We want people to know the facts, and we think transparency and having it all out there is the way to go.
Have you found, is there anybody that is on the right that is kind of trying to disavow some of this stuff? I mean, it would seem that, you know, if you're on the right and you have legitimate political differences,
yeah.
and people do, and that's fair, that's very different from sending out something, you know, saying somebody's a religion that they're not, or that, you know, there's something embedded in a bill which obviously isn't there.
I mean,
is there somebody kind of saying, hey, you know, put an end to the nonsense and let's have a legitimate debate?
Yeah, in fact, we devoted a chapter to why the brakes failed, so to speak. There are people out there, normal mainstream conservatives. Look, you know, I'm not a conservative, but I grew up in southern Idaho. I have a lot of conservative friends. I believe, you know, one time myself was fairly conservative as well. I don't believe that conservatism in itself is by any means a bad thing. I think it's a very healthy part of our national dialogue. But But right-wing extremism is not conservatism. And conservatives need to understand that their movement's being taken over by right-wing extremists. And it's damaging for conservatism, too. So there are people like David Frum and David Brooks out there who do try to push back, but they're up against Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck, and right now it's an insurmountable task to try to do it.
I mean, there were a lot of things said over the healthcare debate, and I mean, I remember watching some of these things and getting those emails about, you know, the death panels. It's just shocking.
Well, Sarah Palin came up with that one for us.
It seems like it's very difficult to take the position of a lot of the folks on the right seriously if they don't disavow these things. And I mean, the folks that you bring up, I mean, I remember when Frum kind of was critical of some of the extreme, it seemed like the people, even in the mainstream Republican Party, were kind of disavowing him.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's because they're all slaves to Rush. Because, of course, when Frum did this, he was attacked by what I recall Frum doing particularly was criticizing Sarah Palin during the 2008 campaign. And, you know, all the Bill Kristols and all the Sarah defenders out there just slagged him. And I think it has a lot to do with why he got removed, or where did he leave? What magazine was it? Reason? No, not Reason. Commentary? Anyway. Anyway, he's no longer there.
Do you think there's getting to be a voice anywhere, though, in the Republican Party that is other than the Rush Limbaughs and the Glenn Becks? I mean, I have family and friends, even people on the right, who say to me, where did Glenn Beck come from? Why is this guy the spokesperson for the right? What happened to the William F. Buckleys that, you know, maybe were right of center, obviously, but were very eloquent?
Well, a lot of it has to do, I think, with the history of the conservative movement. I mean, let's be honest. Going back to Goldwater and Nixon and the use of the Southern Strategy, the conservative movement has risen largely on the backs of the politics of resentment, what Rick Perlstein calls, you know, the politics of resentment, and I think that's right, wedge politics. And I think that, unfortunately, by the end of 2008, the regular GOP brand was so severe, you know, the regular corporate mainstream Republican GOP brand was so severely damaged by the Bush years that conservatives understood innately that they needed to do a complete makeover. But the only makeover available to them within the framework of the politics of resentment that they've exploited all these years is right-wing populism. And the Tea Party is fundamentally right-wing populism. Well, right-wing populism is also fundamentally irrational. It's it is at its core, you know, it's this idea that you can that corporate leaders are the people who are going to save us. You know, Henry Ford back in the 30s was the primary figure for right-wing populists, and nowadays we have Glenn Beck out there defending AIG, you know. So they don't think everything through, but what they play on is cultural resentments, the idea of cultural elites. You know, the whole narrative of right-wing populism is that ordinary working producers, the people who produce for society, are being constantly victimized by the liberal conniving elites at the top and the parasitic there's a real racial connotation to it, but it also class as well, but the parasitic lower classes who are supposed to be causing, you know, all of our national fiscal problems or something like that.
And why isn't the anger, though, redirected? I mean, you look at some of the contracting with Halliburton. I mean, when people talk about government spending, I mean, billions and billions of dollars that, you know, nobody can figure out what it was spent on, what it was doing things that people don't support. I mean, the anger certainly on some level makes some sense, but it seems to be directed at the wrong place.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way to me. To me, it's astonishing that they can get away with doing it, but it's Again, what they often play to is cultural resentments. You know, this idea that, well, you know, these elites look down their noses at you, so therefore you should hate, you should always be on our side, and that sort of thing. Of course, the conservatives themselves are terribly elitist as well. So it's not all that logical, but or rational, but. Rationality really doesn't have anything to do with this.
So for more information, folks can go to crooksandliars.com. We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com.
Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. You'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from. Start shopping today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com. We've been joined by Eric Luckey, the Research Director for Campaign for America's Future. We're here at their conference, and so tell us what's going on here at the conference.
We're getting the progressive movement together, and we're getting all people from all over the country together for two reasons. One, we are all a little bit dispirited. We are all a little bit disappointed, and we all mobilized for change in 2008, and then we looked at what happened, and yeah, we got this, and it was good, and we got that, and it was good, but a lot of us are disappointed. So that's one reason we're coming together. And then the other reason we're coming together is, man, we can't be disappointed. We really need to come out hard in 2010 because the right wing is angry and the right wing is mobilized. And if all of us sit home disappointed, we're really going to be in trouble. We've got a fight ahead of us. We had a fight behind us. Yay, we did great in 2008. Yay, let's not forget to do a little bit of cheering. We did get universal health care. The Recovery Act was hugely important to keep the economy from falling off the cliff. And at the same time, well, the healthcare bill, it was compromised. It was missing some things. Some promises fell short. We got to keep on fighting. So we're going to keep on fighting in 2010. We're going to talk about that at this conference. We'll talk about all the different dimensions, the infrastructure, the healthcare, the financial reform. But in the background, it's going to take us a while to get the change we need, not just one election.
And, you know, I think a lot of us were really geared up when you know, the election was over. It looked like you know, there was some control by progressives in both the Senate and the House. But things kind of seemed to stall. And I think progressives are always putting it, you know, on the folks that they elected. But in some ways, really, shouldn't the focus of the disappointment be with the people that are blocking everything?
I think that's exactly right. The Republicans obstructed. The Republicans filibustered everything in the Senate. Their main talking point was no. They made things up that were false accusations, you know, the death panels in healthcare, for example. And no matter what it is that we say, they say it's going to kill jobs. And so they're just making stuff up. But on the one hand, that's their job. Or, you know, well, I know I'm being a little bit too kind there. They could be Americans. They could be elected officials who are responsibly trying to move to solve problems. But they're not. They're being an opposition party, and they're saying no to everything. And in a certain sense, that's expected of them. They are obstructing. How are the Democrats doing in response? So the Republicans are hitting a really hard serve, and the Democrats are not hitting it back very well. And so a lot of us are angry at the Democrats, and you know, we're right to be angry. There's some real disappointment, and they could have been fighting, they should have been fighting, and they got to get back to fighting because now it's campaign time again. But when we're really being angry, let's please not forget to be angry at the Republicans. They're the people who are doing the obstruction.
Now to play devil's advocate the other way, let's look at maybe some of the ways the bills have come over into Congress. On health care, for instance, a lot of progressives really wanted to see single payer and thought single payer was the way to go. If the bill had started out as single payer and then got compromised down to maybe where we are, if the Republicans had supported it, you know, in a certain mind's eye, that makes sense. But to kind of start out where we did and compromise down from there and still not get Republican support, is that maybe part of the reason maybe we're coming in asking for a half a loaf instead of coming in and asking for the loaf?
Right. I think that's fair. I mean, that's a fair piece of hindsight. It's fair Monday morning quarterbacking. You learn from mistakes. On the other hand, the approach that was taken was not unreasonable. It was, let's walk in there with something that's really quite sellable. The public option was really what it comes down to. Let's have a public option. We're not going to dislocate the entire private sector, private health insurance industry all at once. Let's just make it that if you want to buy into something like Medicare, you can. The way Obama campaigned on it. You like your private health insurance, keep it. You don't have access to it or you don't like it, you can buy into something like Medicare. That's a sensible option, and I think it made good sense to go that way rather than we must fight for single payer, which would also not have been crazy, right? But the notion of let's have this public option was a very sensible alternative. The trouble was they didn't fight for it. That's where the disappointment comes in. They didn't fight for it. They didn't fight hard enough. They could have gotten it. And especially last summer was really important. The president was AWOL, and the Democrats were in many ways leaderless, and they were trying to be bipartisan. They bought into this notion that we need to be bipartisan, which is a different way of saying Republicans have the ability to make us a failure. Because if we want the measure of success to be bipartisanship and Republican votes, and Obama saying things like, I want a bill that I can get 100 votes in the U.S. Senate, not 51 or 61, as it turns out, right? But, you know, Obama saying, I want to vote where I can get a bill where I can get 100 votes is a different way of saying Republicans have veto power. They can make me a failure. Because if I insist on if my holy grail is bipartisanship and all they want to do is obstruct and make me fail, then they can. I will come out as a failure. So we didn't wise up to that fast enough and say they are saying no no matter what, so we're taking our majorities and we're going to get some good stuff passed.
And do you think that's going to happen before the election? Are we going to get a few more good things as we go into the election?
I am hopeful. First of all, that there's some learning curve and that they've learned some things the hard way. And secondly, that it's an election season, so you're allowed to campaign. Whereas last year, Obama in particular, I felt like he was like, look, the campaigning is done. Now it's governance time. Now we're doing policy, not politics. Well, now it's politics time again. It's campaign season. You better get out there and campaign. And especially if you want us campaigning for you. Back to this conference and what it's all about is we got to motivate the base. And us, the base, you know, we need to be out there fighting for people, and they need to give us something that we can believe in.
And for folks out there that have been hit by the economy or, you know, affected, I mean, all of us have been affected to some extent by the economy. How do we fix that problem? What's the Campaign for America's Future view on that?
I think the economy is hard. First of all, we just need to do it. We need to realize the problem is jobs. We need to fix the economy. And don't be out here talking about deficits 30 years from now. I mean, deficits are a problem, but deficits are always in the background. What we need to do right now, we need to fix the economy. And it turns out we can do it in a couple of easy steps. Watch this. Fix the infrastructure. Rebuild the infrastructure. Our leaky old schools, our potholed roads, our electric grid where we keep on getting blackouts. We need to fix the old infrastructure. And we need to build new infrastructure, high-speed rail, this kind of a thing. So we need to rebuild our infrastructure, and this is really important, people don't always say this, with parts made in America. Parts made in America. Rebuild the infrastructure with parts made in America, new energy, solar cells, wind turbines, double pane glass, all that stuff. We need to break the old oil stranglehold on our economy, new energy economy, and again, parts made in America. The clean energy jobs, those wind turbines should not be shipped across the sea from China. So, and then we got to pay for it. Progressive taxation, the Bush tax cuts need to end. There's options that are out there, and we just need to do them. We need to identify them and fight for them.
Now, you know, building stuff in America seems like that should be a bipartisan kind of thing. I mean, it, you know, obviously we want to keep jobs here. We want to do the best we can for America. It's a patriotic thing. Where's the Chamber of Commerce been on this?
It's amazing. The multinational corporations don't care where it's made. And if Nike can make the sneaker in China and still sell it in America for $100, they're a little better off that way. So the big global business, you remember it used to be what's good for General Motors is good for America? It's not so clear anymore. and the big multinational corporations have a particular interest, which is not necessarily in alignment with the American people and the American worker. And what's very strange is that every other country in the world, its government says, I need to look out for my people. That's what Germany's doing. That's what China's doing. They're looking out for their people. And the American government isn't. The American government is looking out for some ideology of free trade, multinational corporation major donors. And the American people, well, they just need to understand the ideology of free trade. And that capitalism is hard, and the way I see it, capitalism says, I need to be out there negotiating for my people, and you can negotiate for your people, and we'll go back and forth, and we'll hit a compromise. We'll hit a price that I'm willing to pay and you're willing to buy it at. And that's free market capitalism. Instead, what we have is all the other countries looking out for their people, and our government isn't.
And speaking of jobs, the green jobs economy, that's been a big thing for the administration. When they came in, everybody was really jazzed up that we were going to have all these green jobs. I was going to have solar panels on my roof and a geothermal in my backyard, and you know, the wind turbines were going to be everywhere. Where are we with this? Why isn't that happening faster?
It's starting to move in that direction, and the main reason it's not happening faster is we're not putting enough energy, if you will, into it. So that the Recovery Act from last year, it put something like $8 billion into this renewable energy sector. It didn't especially care where it was made. So the wind turbines might as well come from China, which is a missing clause. Because China will manipulate its currency, and China is subsidizing its export industry specifically in order to grab this part of the growing global economy, and the U.S. isn't playing there. We need to do something about Chinese currency manipulation. We can come back to that if you want. But so the clean energy economy, and we just need to get going at it. We know what to do, the solar cells on the roof, the wind turbines, and the simple things. The insulation, the double pane glass, and the transportation dimension, high speed rail, transportation and energy. Somebody made a comment the other day, you know, in the U.S. Congress, there's a transportation committee and there's an energy committee. They should just be one committee because it's almost the same thing. True enough.
Let's go on a different tack. You're also an author. Tell us a little about your novel.
I wrote a book a little while ago, 2044. Y'all remember George Orwell's 1984, Big Brother is watching you, Big Brother, the Leviathan government out of control. And I said one day, wait a minute, it didn't turn out that way. It's not the government that's out of control, the private sector took over, the private sector runs the place. It's not Big Brother government, it's Big Brother Incorporated. Someone should write a book about that. 2044. 2044, the webpage is 2044thenovel.com. So 2044thenovel.com. And in 2044, the key issue is water. The world is running short on water by 2044. And a couple of industries, a couple of businesses control the water supply. A lot like oil right now. And so some inventive entrepreneur comes up with a way to take the salt out of seawater. Yay, water all around, not a drop to drink, but now we could drink it. How wonderful would this be? But the businesses who are in control don't like that. That's the story. 2044, the novel.
So as we come down to our last 30 seconds, what do you think the outgrowth of the conference is going to be? What are we hoping to achieve in the end?
We are hoping to get people mobilized instead of disappointed so that they're not sitting at home saying, Obama dropped the ball and the Democrats keep on compromising. They're out there saying, we need to fight for change. We fought to get a black man elected president in 2008. Can you still believe that? We're fighting for change. We need to keep on